Welcome back to part three of Fighting Addiction. I'm Hannah Stanley, host of On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. Joining me now is Dan Cooper, co-executive director of Adler's Institute on Social Exclusion. And as always, I do want to remind you, the listener, to take a moment and please hit subscribe and also share this content if you want on your social media. We would appreciate it. Now, Dan, again, thank you for joining us again. You've been here before.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Of course. Your area of expertise on this particular topic is more at the policy level. What's your current take on the approach to drugs and addiction?
Yeah, so I'm going to take a step back and zoom out a little bit and talk about mass incarceration. And in order to tell that story, it's important to talk about the war on drugs and also how this war on drugs has really been a war on neighborhoods. And looking at Chicago, it's really a war on the West and the South Side. And so then it's important to think about this in terms of not just ending the drug war, but really undoing the harm that's been caused to neighborhoods by the drug war. So I'll start there. So a lot of people have heard the term mass incarceration. Just to, you know, give it the most concise in a nutshell summary, we went from having about 200,000 people in jails and prison in the late 70s to having over 7 million people in correctional control by the late
nationwide.
Nationwide,
okay.
Right. So the highest rate in the world. Yay, we're number one, unfortunately, in that dubious statistic. So we have 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prisoners. And this whole phenomenon started with the war on drugs. So Richard Nixon coined the term, but it wasn't really until Reagan in the early 80s, 1982, that this really took off.
Just say no.
Just say no, right. And so I think it's also important to note that this wasn't necessarily responding to a huge drug crisis. Drug rates had been falling since the late 70s. I think there was a survey that came out before Reagan doubled down on the war on drugs, where only about 2% of the population identified drug use as the big problem in the country. And then after we started talking about the war on drugs and the need to get tough on crime, it wasn't until later that people said, yes, we identify this as a problem. So the war on drugs was really a marketing campaign in some ways to drum up support for increased policing, suppression. And so what really happened is that, you know, we had a massive transformation in the way the federal government incentivized policing, in the way we sentenced people for drug-related offenses. Mandatory minimums for the use of crack cocaine, possession, use, and sale of crack cocaine went way up in the early 80s. The budgets for the FBI and the Department of Defense, the drug enforcement agencies, all swelled while we reduced funding for things like the National Institute on Drug Abuse. We passed truth in sentencing laws, meaning that people who are sentenced for a crime have to serve a certain percentage of their time. And so all of these mandates came down from the federal government. There was all this money available to police departments in cities like Chicago. And so nobody wants to leave money on the table, so you go where the money is. And overnight, we have police forces transformed into military units with a lot more weapons who are getting federal money to go after drug enforcement. And what this translated to for places like Chicago is going to the West Side and the South Side. And instead of doing community policing, where we're trying to build relationships and, you know, kind of this Andy Griffith idea of what police are, where we're building relationships, it really turned into policies like stop and frisk, having a reasonable suspicion to pull anyone over and do a search of a car for minor traffic violations, for example. And so then what we get in the 80s is an overnight swelling of the jail and prison population, largely of African Americans. So African Americans in the country make up about 12 to 13% or so of the population, but 60% of those imprisoned.
And what they're doing is they're kind of sweeping through those neighborhoods where there's higher drug use or more percentage by the population drug use. So it's easier to find.
Well, so that point would be disputed, I think. So drug use rates are pretty similar across ethnicities,
and neighborhoods.
White people, yeah,
okay.
Use drugs Drug sales, maybe there's a higher density, but and that's the big but. Getting back to the idea of not asking or not focusing on the fact that there is drug use, but asking the question why, or drug sales rather, asking the question why, right? And so in Chicago, the West and South Side, these are the same neighborhoods that were segregated through the use of racial covenants and redlining, where we essentially created segregated neighborhoods that were completely disinvested, where we allowed landlords to be abusive, deterioration of properties, slumlords, the explosion of poverty. Also in the 80s, we have rapid deindustrialization. Manufacturing jobs are moving overseas. These same neighborhoods are hit hardest by deindustrialization. So we have this perfect storm. We have excess labor and high unemployment, and so it's an easy place to go in and police and make drug arrests.
Okay, and as we learned in our second segment with when Jeff Baeche was joining us, some of these people who are using more frequently also have other things that have happened to them, either trauma or crisis, and that would lead to that as well.
That's right. And so you think about trauma and crisis and how much of that is driven by broader determinants, not personal level characteristics, but things going on in the neighborhood you live in, right? If you witness violence on a day-to-day basis because you've now lived in generations of poverty where we've segregated, we've disinvested, we've funded police to go in and act as a military force, you're experiencing a lot of trauma. You're less likely to receive a good education. So you're failed by many different systems. So those are kind of the root causes of what's happening here, thinking about it as a public health issue.
So what's the next step on getting us to the next level?
Yeah, so... I'm beating this drum.
Where does the front go? Right. I mean, if this is a quote unquote war on drugs, how do we shift
this? So one thing that has happened in Chicago, so Chicago has decriminalized marijuana use, for example, and the war on drugs. You know, one of the great myths is that we're really going after top level dealers and really serious users. There was definitely prioritization of crack cocaine, but also a lot of people ending up in prison were marijuana users or people selling marijuana. So what Chicago's done recently is they've scaled back enforcement of marijuana possession and shifted to fines. However, and this is a big however, the Chicago Justice Project came out with a report about a year or two ago saying that the fines are massively disproportionate by geography and by race, right? So the fines we're now handing out for marijuana possession are in the same neighborhoods, the West and South Side, where we were formerly policing, arresting, sentencing people to jail and prison for this. And so that's definitely not part of the solution because, again, these are the same neighborhoods that have been wrecked by years of bad policy, and we're punishing the people who can least afford to pay those fines.
All right. This is something I don't understand. And so because this would be kind of a policy thing, so we're going to talk about this really fast. If I get a parking ticket in Lincoln Park, it's going to cost the same if I get a parking ticket in Hyde Park. A parking ticket's a parking ticket, depending on the violation, right? You know, like expired meter, it's, I don't know, $50 or something. Why would a fine for I don't even know how it's measured, a gram or an ounce or whatever of marijuana be different in different neighborhoods?
Yeah, it's not so much the amount, it's the number.
Shouldn't there be a chart somewhere?
Yeah, well, I encourage folks to check out the Chicago Justice Project's work on this and some other. I believe the Chicago Reader put out a great article, maybe it was Angela Caputo, demonstrating this. And it wasn't so much differential level of fines, it's just that we're going into the same neighborhoods. We're not going after people in Lincoln Park or on the north side. We're going after people on the west side and on the south side. Because we've had years and years of police patterning where that's where we enforce, right? And I think that's a big problem, right? So the answer is definitely decriminalization, but and this is going to be my big but, we can't just walk away and say, okay, we've created a monster through the war on drugs. Now let's just scale back our enforcement a little bit. We really have to repair the damage because these neighborhoods, more and more research is coming out. Have been made worse by mass incarceration, right? So the poverty rate by some measures, by some research, is higher because of mass incarceration, right? So, we've disrupted families and, the kind of social fabric of neighborhoods when you have large percentages of the population returning from prison, going to prison. That destabilizes families. That destabilizes, the long-term residents there, who are the people who have the eyes on the street and, you know, make the neighborhood a good, safe place. You have that massive disruption. And so we've done this generation after generation, and we can't just expect that now if we make a few reductions in drug sentencing or step back enforcement that these neighborhoods will pick themselves up by their bootstraps. We need to be reinvesting money into them, into drug treatment programs, into better education and workforce development, all the things that we would be able to do if we didn't have this massive budget impasse at the state level.
I mentioned earlier you were a guest here before, and that was actually more what we were talking about, mm-hmm. was different ways to handle things without incarcerating people. So obviously you're an expert. And if you, listeners, if you missed that, I do encourage you to go back. I believe that was episode one. And that was really, really fascinating information also. But goes hand in hand with what we're talking about today, because by creating that higher levels of incarcerations in these neighborhoods, we're creating more trauma, we're creating more crisis and more stress, and higher levels of unemployment. And then that's going to lead to psychological concerns or issues that then might lead them to drug use to help cover that. And this is fascinating. Oh, this is such a bigger issue.
Yeah, I would say drug use and drug sales, right? So we're all...
Because that's a thing to do to make money.
Especially if you come back to a disinvested neighborhood with failing schools, few job prospects, and you have the added stigma of having a record that presents a real barrier to you finding employment. A large percentage of people are going to end up back into the so-called informal economy. And so instead of just going after them and rearresting, resentencing, we need a better approach. We need to think about what we can do in these neighborhoods to, fund, human and community development. And it seems like this would be an impossible thing to get done because, you know, nobody wants to spend money at the federal government level or the state government level. But we did it once. We did it under Reagan, who is a small budget conservative. He massively increased federal funding for drug enforcement, right, and for policing and suppression. And so if we could do that, why can't we do the same thing, increase the budget for drug treatment, increase the budget for workforce development programs?
But it all comes down to who's voting and the education of, and I don't mean that flippantly because people are smart, but the education of those who are voting and those we're voting in. We need our politicians who are making policy and our policy writers, because they're not always the same people, to be educated about the harm that our current policies can be causing, or at least are not helping to prevent.
Yes. So that's a great point because, you know, although mass incarceration really started with the drug war, since the 90s and 2000s, there have been more people sentenced for violent offenses or property crimes than there have been drug offenses. And a lot of that comes down to the fact that district and state's attorneys, judges are all elected. And you get elected on a platform of getting tough on crime. We as the voters we're so programmed to hear, oh, well, yeah, that this judge or this district attorney is going to get tough on crime. I'm down with that. You know, this is kind of a message that works, and people are afraid to say, I'm going to take a different approach. I'm going to do everything I can to keep young people and young people of color or adults out of the prison system, you know, because they're afraid their opponent is going to say that they're weak on crime. You know, the Willie Horton moment that ad that was run back in the 80s in the presidential campaign, right?
Yeah, no, that's... And I get it. I do. I would probably say the same thing if I was running for office. But it really needs to start with having everybody listen to the podcast. So that's where we need to get everybody doing is helping to educate the general populace that there is a different school of thought that's proven that can help, because it's a vicious cycle that we're in right now.
Right. Absolutely. And for me, there's compelling research out there, and maybe it's hard to translate this into a soundbite that people can really swallow. But, you know, incarceration, the sort of prison churning, the in and out of prison at the neighborhood level actually might lead to more crime. There's compelling research that's coming out saying that our incarceration rates are predicting later increases in crime for a lot of reasons, right? The destabilizing effects that I mentioned earlier. And so to disrupt that cycle, it's really cutting back on our sentencing and going all into building these neighborhoods, making them safer places, not through suppression, but through human development, drug treatment, community development, affordable housing, things that would attract investment into neighborhoods, for example. So I think a good bellwether for this kind of concept is the current state's attorney's race that we have right now. So the incumbent, Anita Alvarez, I think represents very much this get tough on crime approach, and her opponent, Kim Fox, I think has been using a lot of this language that mass incarceration hasn't made us safer. So I think that's an interesting one for voters to watch to see if these messages can really resonate about, you know, doing things differently as a prosecutor.
Restorative justice, by the way, was the topic on the podcast that Dan was previously on as well, where we talked about more in depth on reducing some of the levels of incarceration. How generationally, how long does this damage last? If we were to stop it now, let's say everything was bright and shiny. You know, I read a study the other day that generations from the Holocaust still have differences in how they handle crisis and stress because that's something that's in their DNA. Is this something that's going to be in the neighborhood DNA for a generation or two, or we don't know?
That's a great question. And I would say the simplest answer is that I don't know, and nobody knows. But one thing is,
because we haven't fixed it yet.
We haven't. And what's also, I love your term of the neighborhood DNA, because what's also in the neighborhood DNA is segregation and redlining. And then it was hyper-segregation and mass incarceration and drug enforcement and poor community police relationships, right? And so that's in the neighborhood DNA that's been passed down generation after generation. And so I think that's why it's so important not to just say, okay, we're going to put our hands up and walk away from drug enforcement. We have to do more to kind of right the wrong, right? Morally, yes, but also economically, you know, because we're not just going to – these neighborhoods aren't just going to all of a sudden become transformed places because we're not enforcing or we're not policing them as much as we used to. I think there needs to be a massive shift in resources.
And with not necessarily the same hard line. Policing
That's
is
right.
good. We're there for a reason. They're there for a reason to keep everyone safe and, you know, to enforce laws. But to do it with such a focus on certain things, and it really creates a stigma that the older generations are going to, you know, keep talking about to the younger generation. So even if we change it now, there's still going to be some of that lore.
Absolutely.
In the land.
Yeah. So these policies are socially reproduced over time. And thinking about stigma, I mean, think about going to certain neighborhoods and seeing a police camera with a flashing blue light. I mean, that's a very clear symbol or signal we're sending to people that this is a bad neighborhood, this is a dangerous neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And so what kind of chance does that neighborhood have in attracting a new grocery store or new businesses, you know, who will also see that flashing blue light and say, this is not where I want to locate, this is a bad place. So definitely we need to do more to kind of change these neighborhoods for the better.
Thank you so much, Dan. That concludes our show on addiction, fighting addiction. Please join us next week for our episode, Still Work to Do in LGBTQ Rights. Again, I'm Hannah Stanley, and this is on Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. And again, please be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes and share via your social networks. Thanks so much for listening.